Well, at the same time that Homer and the bards of ancient Greece were composing and performing the Odyssey and the Iliad, epic myths that would shape not only the sensibility and quests of ancient Greece and then Rome, but of many aspects of Western civilization, the ancient Hebrews were crafting their own great sagas, stories that would shape the world by a very different method and route. Now, there's no doubt that if you're to make a movie, have a choice of which of these sagas you'd make a movie of, the battlefields, the monsters, the epic adventures of Odysseus and Achilles and the surrounding cast of gods and villains, often the same thing in those stories, interestingly enough, well, that's way more entertaining than the prima facie, far tamer adventures of Abram, Sarai, and wider clan. I mean, there's some exceptions. You can think about the incident at Sodom and Gomorrah, the great horrific scene that unfolds there with fire falling from heaven. You can think about the 10 plagues of Moses and the horrors and the liberation that results from that. But if we just stick with this original part, this first saga amongst the other sagas, if you were minding your sheep on some of the Canaanite, on some Canaanite hillside, and this nomadic clan were to pass you and your Ba'aing brood, you might stare at them for a while, you might wonder where they've come from, where they're going, but once they were gone, you'd most likely never think of them again. And even if you were traveling with the clan, say as a servant, what you would notice probably wouldn't be that particularly inspiring. Indeed, as the stories come to us, we see that most of the central characters don't appear in a heroic light. Abe appears particularly skittish. I mean, how do you characterize someone who tries to pawn off his wife as his sister several times because she's apparently so beautiful that he's afraid he'll be killed by the more powerful people he's come into contact with if they discover she's his wife? But here's the strange thing. This story, this saga of Abraham and Sarah, as they come to be known, and the slowly evolving clan that comes from them will change the world, actually, more profoundly than even the greatness of Greece or Rome after them. And that's, of course, because of the one that follows from them, that comes from them. But even he, who we gather today to worship, is similar in character, not in the non-heroic part maybe, but in the nondescriptness, if you will. Abraham and Sarah's power lies precisely in the fact that they don't, on the surface of things at least, seem to have what it takes to change the world. What they have is a relationship with the one God who created the world. And so nothing comparable is found in any other ancient text. Here, to this hitherto unknown couple, we have the astounding promise, through you all the families of the earth will be blessed. But why is this great promise of blessing made to them? We don't know. They just show up in the biblical narrative. And that's the scandal of the story, if you will. They seem to be a moderately successful Sumerian couple, family, but there's nothing in their pedigree that would suggest what is promised to them. In contrast, both Odysseus and Achilles have bloodlines that you can trace to particular gods. But the God of all creation who makes these promises to Abraham and Sarah, how that happened, what that looked like, we don't know. It doesn't tell us. But most clearly, it was a very strong inward interior conviction. The God who does this does so with very great tact, very unlike the gods in the Greek myths. The God of all creation respects their expectations even as God makes them, makes the promises to them. This again is unique in ancient literature. By epic standards, there is, as one writer puts it, a very great quiet in God's dealings with this family. Again, you wouldn't see it if you looked at them. And yet there is an interior reality that is truly awesome, not only of their awareness of God, but of God's own intense awareness and commitment and even pursuit of them. Well, what is this interior reality? Earlier this week at our midweek Eucharist, our practice is to use the texts for the following Sunday and just do a brief Lectio Divina around the texts if we're not studying them explicitly. And so people were sharing their reflections, a word or a phrase, and someone mentioned in connection with this story the extraordinary level of obedience it would have taken to step out in the way that they did. And I was really happy that this person said it, a little bit upset because I knew I'd now have to rewrite what I wrote for my sermon. But I'm really happy they said it because I thought back to my earlier self when I was 15 or 16, when if someone had asked me to think about serving God in a radical way, I would have fled in horror and fear. In fact, one of the ways that pastors could scare me as a child or as a teenager was to say, well, you better be careful because God might call you as a missionary. You better just be prepared for that. And I would, no, please. I mean, I wanted, most of us want, to craft our own destiny, especially here in Western culture. The last thing we want is some outside authority telling us what we should pursue for our life's purpose. So to sharpen the question, what is this interior reality experienced by Abraham and Sarah that would convince them of this extraordinary level of obedience, as this parishioner rightly put it? And then I thought about when I met Denise, and how once I was in love, I would have followed her anywhere, really. No sacrifice would have seemed too much to make at that time in my life. And I think that is the secret of Abraham and Sarah. It's the secret of Matthew's conversion as well in our gospel reading. Not some superhuman ability to obey God and turn away from a former life through that obedience, but the reception of a great acceptance, a great love, a sense that they are secure and cared for before they change at all, before they embark on any journey. A sense that they can count on what God is offering them more than on any accomplishment they might forge themselves. the very happiest, that's a kind of a crass word, but very happiest Christians I have ever met are not the holiest. I mentioned that Abraham often acts worse than the pagans around them. It's actually true. Like, if you read the story, it's one of those amazing things about how the crafters of these stories were just so brutally honest about their forebears. They didn't try to sugarcoat them. The pagans who have had Sarai pawned off on them as a sister, why would you do this? Don't you know that's really not right? And Abraham, you know, he's the chosen one, right? So he's definitely not the holiest guy around. And Matthew, as a tax collector, would have been presumably responsible for abusive behavior towards the poor. So what accounts for the conversion and the ongoing life of the very happiest Christians I've ever met is not their ability to intellectually understand the finer points of Christian theology, and it's certainly not their ability to live perfectly. In fact, it's kind of like the opposite. There's scrupulous Christians who you want to avoid at all costs, right? You know the kind of person I'm talking about. They are often among the most unhappy Christians I know. Rather, these people are those who know at a very deep level that they've been called, accepted, and loved by a God whose great desire is to do those things, to forgive them, to bless them, and to guide them. From that basis, there is no journey that is not possible. When that is your core belief, even to the point of all the families of the earth being blessed through you, even to the point where a former tax collector is associated with a gospel that bears his name, whether he wrote it or not is another intellectual squabble, but it's associated with his name, in which the acts of God's mercy are now the main currency, not coin or cattle. This is why, as Paul will say in his most famous letter, that Abraham and Sarah are the key to understanding what Christ is all about. It's because they experienced grace, the gift of blessing, identity, and a life's journey that they didn't earn or initiate. The love of Jesus that lives in us and defines us and moves us. Now, I'm aware that when I look at each of you, I am largely ignorant of the interior realities and journeys you are on. How one of the main reasons we should never judge a book by its cover is that we are far more than even we know. That the most prosaic of lives that pass us by, even as we are minding the proverbial sheep, if you will, might contain awesome realities, harbingers of change and discovery that will yet move us all. What I am more sure of is what these central stories stand for in relationship to each of us. And what I covet for each of you, for my children and grandchildren, for those who will in the next years and generation come to experience this community, is simply this: the gospel. Just the gospel. The extraordinary power of an acceptance and forgiveness that results in the joy of leaving all that binds us. It sometimes means that we trade in very good things for the best thing. And what I pray is that our individual and common journey as in and towards the gospel always, towards the beauty, goodness, and truth of Him who frees us. And I understand that for many of us, we'll be like Abram in this. We'll have to journey on in stages. It won't happen to us in an instant, but it will be the blessed journey of a lifetime. May it be so in each of our hearts here today. Amen.